want to pledge to form an inclusive government and respect human rights and women's freedom within their version of the Islamic law. Taliban sources say the group's co-founder and head of political office, Mullah Baradar, will lead the new government in Afghanistan. The EU foreign policy chief says a bloc will engage with the Taliban in order to support the Afghan people, but it does not mean it will recognize a new government there. The United Nations has resumed its humanitarian flights to northern and southern Afghanistan, enabling scores of humanitarian organizations to continue life-saving activities there. The U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops before the end of August deadline, ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan. Joining us now from the Afghan capital, Kabul, is our correspondent, Amin Alami, with all the latest developments in Afghanistan. Amin.
Well, Badia, a blame game is underway in Afghanistan, particularly here in the Afghan capital, on the issue of Panjshir. Taliban sources, mainly its field commanders, say that we have successfully captured the entire Panjshir province in northeastern part of Afghanistan. But in the meantime, Ahmed Massoud, as well as Amrullah Saleh, who are leading the resistance front in northern Panjshir province of Afghanistan, have also released separate messages saying that, insisting that we are inside Panjshir and that we have not left this key area, and that we are going to resist against the Taliban until we gain victory against these troops. According to Amrullah Saleh, as well as according to a tweet by Ahmed Massoud, who is the leader of Northern Resistance Front, a propaganda has been launched by the enemy of the National Resistance Front in order to gain more morale for the defeated fighters around Panjshir province. This comes as the Taliban earlier had said that we are in full control of Panjshir. In the meantime, some top political leaders, mainly Abdullah Abdullah, former chief of Afghanistan's High Reconciliation Council, as well as Hamid Karzai, the former Afghan president, are doing their best here in Kabul to convince both sides in order to approve a ceasefire that will that should lead both sides to resume negotiations in order to reach a peaceful agreement.
All right, thanks a lot, Amin Alami, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. How we're joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have writer and blogger, social activist and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Mr. Sayed Muaz Shah, joining us from Karachi. Also, we have journalist and political analyst Shahid Qureshi, who's joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Muaz Shah in Karachi. As we know, the Taliban are set to announce a new government soon. What are your expectations, having in mind the promises that they've made about being an inclusive government?
I think this is an interesting place to start because, you know, as you know, the news was that today we were going to get some sort of insight to that. But I think the activities and recent events in Panjshir Valley have kind of stalled that announcement. But as you stated earlier, there are sources, reliable sources, that have reported that Mullah Baradar would be the head of this new government. Along with that, there's some indication of the former leadership, including Mullah Yaqub, who may come in a second tier of leadership as well. But when I think about the inclusive nature of the government, I think there was some discussion, obviously, that's been going on from the beginning with Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah. And there was a source that recently disclosed that, you know, with Hamid Karzai, he, you know, in quote unquote, is an old horse, and that they were probably not going to engage him in an official capacity. That is yet to be seen. But that Abdullah is someone that they would probably most likely engage in some sort of discussion. And we see that clearly in the, as you indicated, that they are the mid-go-level people negotiating between the Panjshir Valley resistance and the Taliban. So the Taliban have some sort of trust that they're able to come out with a negotiated solution. As you know, that they have been negotiating with the Panjshir Valley elders for quite some time, for weeks, in fact, even before the Americans left. And there was a movement to that. But there was a lot of discussion. Some of the discussion that came to fore that was recently reported was that one of the negotiating elements was that the Panjshir Valley resistance was requesting somewhere around 30% of the ministerial seats, which was something that the Taliban just would not accept. And that's why we're seeing what we see. And if you even watched Amanullah Saleh's own tweet and Twitter account before today's tweet, he recently actually tweeted about how the Taliban had cut the electricity and the internet connection. And in fact, if you actually observe very carefully in Amr al-Saleh's video that recently, that you were referring to, that they're still there, you can hear the humming of a diesel generator in the background. So it's quite possible that they're still there. But I think one of the key things is that there has been significant change in the Panjshir Valley. We'll find tomorrow morning what the situation is. It may not have entirely fallen, but Taliban most likely, through all the sources, do indicate they have made significant gains there.
All right, Mr. Qureshi in London, what about pledges by countries to engage with the Taliban? There's Russia, there's China, there are other countries in the region. The British Foreign Secretary says there's a need to engage with the Taliban in Afghanistan. The EU Foreign Policy Chief says a bloc will engage with the Taliban, but it doesn't mean it will recognize a new government there. What will be the extent and nature of these relationships, in your opinion?
Well, thank you. It's a good question. What I believe is that what are the challenges the current victors of the current war against the occupying forces of colonialists who were occupying Afghanistan for the last 20 years. The challenge is that they have activated their tools like IMF, World Bank. They've frozen their assets to make this government to fail. So what needs to happen is the neighboring countries, which you just mentioned, including Pakistan and Iran, for example, Uzbekistan and Russia and China, they should come forward and make sure there's no shortage of food supplies to the people of Afghanistan, because they have been suffering for the last 20 years of these great game. With regards to the international pledges, I mean, they are the losers who are making all these pledges. And as I said before, the tiger won't lose his sleep over the opinion of a sheep. These people have fought with nothing, and they won the war. The war cost to those people who are making pledges $3 trillion, 5,000 or 20,000 injured. So the question is does it really matter to the people who are in power at the moment? The answer is no, it doesn't. But as a matter of legitimacy, and I think it's a good time that the people or the countries should define what does it mean to be called international community. I mean, 3-4 countries who get together and calling themselves international community. That's not. We have more than 200 countries in the world. So when we should use the word international community, that's also a very important question. With regards to Amirullah Saleh and Ahmed Massoud, I think in any ideal situation, these people should be put on trial for war crimes and collaborating with the invaders and occupiers. They are traitors. These people have committed crimes against humanity, against their own people. They were collaborating people who were killing civilians and weddings in drone attacks. This guy, they're calling some resistance forces. They're thieves. They're responsible for stealing the money of the state. As we have seen, the president of with whom Amirullah Saleh has been and Ahmed Massoud have been enjoying the support of those occupiers for the last 20 years. They have no right to come forward and say, call themselves resistance. They are criminals, basically. They should be put on trial. In any ideal situation, the people who should be put on trial is the Dostum, who was responsible for killing its own people. They were Afghans. It's irrelevant if they were Taliban or whatever faction they belong to. But the way the Dostum treated, and these people, Amrullah Saleh especially, he's an Indian stooge, basically. He's a spoiler. He's an ungrateful man who's been accusing Pakistan for a long time. He's an ungrateful man who was blaming Pakistan, who is hosting 3 million of his countrymen for the last 40 years. These people are...
Let's bring in Mr. Moaz Shah back into the discussion. Sorry to interrupt you there. Mr. Moaz Shah, what about the extent and nature of a U.S.-Taliban relationship? That, too, is one of the key issues that needs to be worked out. Like, for example, the U.S. Treasury Department, it says restrictions on Taliban access to the international financial system remains in place. Do you think that's being used as some form of leverage at this point?
Oh, I think definitely it's a political leverage and very relevant. In fact, I think it's almost suicide for Joe Biden to kind of even take us off even a little angle. Right now, his approval ratings are the worst he's ever witnessed in his presidency. So they're going to tread very carefully on that $9 billion that they have in Afghanistan government's money and to release that. And I think that's going to be attached with possibly commitments, certain action items that the Taliban government, I think everybody's waiting really when the Taliban government will be announced officially. And one thing I just wanted to add from Pakistan's side, today's Shah Mahmood Qureshi, the foreign minister, said that we will recognize a Afghanistan government that represents the Afghanistani people. And our commitment is to the people of Afghanistan. So if, again, going to what the previous speaker mentioned, about how the country has come in support of the Taliban in a more broader framework than the existing Kabul regime, I think that's going to play out, and that may we may see the recognition, particularly as you noticed just earlier this week, the Chinese were considered the best friends for the Taliban, and they and the Russians didn't close down their embassies. So there are indications that are very clear. Pakistan also has, the border points at some levels open for humanitarian reasons. And I think we will see probably the regional players in Asia from the Chinese and the Russians primarily first, and then followed by Pakistan, and I believe Iran as well will recognize this government. And I think the Taliban are open to this inclusion of elements of the previous regime and government, but those who have clean hands. And as the previous speaker said, unfortunately, a lot of the leadership and people who are in power have records of corruption. If you even remember, Abdul Ghani and Abdullah were at loggerheads in the previous election, and they had to kind of come to an agreement because of many accusations. And so I think that we will see Abdullah definitely play a significant role, along with some other leaders, as well as we see the Taliban have been more inclusive. In fact, the very commander who is leading the Taliban effort in the Panjshir Valley is a Tajik. And so Taliban have become sensitive to including within their framework other ethnicities, including the Hazara minority. And I think this time the Taliban have a wider mandate that comes with support from all sections of society. And that's because, unfortunately, the hearts and minds were not won by the U.S. occupational forces of the Kabul regime. And Taliban, in turn, in my opinion, in the past 20 years, have inherently won the hearts and minds.
Talking about hearts and minds, Mr. Qureshi, in London, American intelligence assessments, they claim they didn't foresee such a rapid collapse of the Afghan military. British Foreign Minister Dominic Raab said Britain's intelligence assessment was that it was unlikely Kabul would fall this year. Why did the Taliban sweep across the country much more quickly than expected?
Well, I think this is the second failure of the U.S. intelligence and U.S. security system in the last 20 years. They failed on the 9/11. The 15 intelligence agencies, including the U.S. Air Force, completely failed on the day of the 9/11, and they failed to stop those terrorists committing atrocities against the civilians. And then after 20 years spending $3 trillion, they failed again. And that shows this war was not a war. It was more of a scandal of the war military industrial complex, where they found a spot where they can create a conflict, and then they were selling or they were sending military equipment which was not needed in that type of war. In guerrilla warfare, you don't need tanks and Humvees and all these equipments. They send it to Afghanistan. But they were, because they were producing those, and the shareholders were getting rich. And I think it is, I must appreciate President Biden, although people are criticizing him, to take this brave step. Because in damage control, you do not wait for the right time. You just stop where you are, and then you move back and step back. And I think the President Biden has, and also President Trump, made the right decision. They did introspection, because the U.S. infrastructure itself, the roads, the bridges, their own infrastructure is in need, and they need about $2 trillion, because in the last 50 years, they haven't spent enough money on that. With regards to the failure of the intelligence, that shows that the two countries who live in the movies, that is India, who live in Bollywood, and then the Americans who live in Hollywood. So their heroes are these Rambos, and so on the ground, the failure of intelligence, it shows they were relying too much on the electronic gadgetry than having a proper on the ground, on the field, a kind of intelligence and proper assessment.
Okay.
Falling of Afghanistan, falling of Kabul in 36 hours, which they said it's going to be taking 6 months, is a complete failure. In any kind of situation, the boss will sack all those people who were sending those false reports, false assessments back home. And I think in any kind of business model, if you have these kind of employees who are not performing, who spent too much money, and the money disappeared into offshore safe havens, in banks, and the Wall Street is obviously responsible for all this death and destruction and war profiteering, as well as the, I must say that this the Western media especially keep on talking about the rights of the women and the rights of the children. I don't know why they don't talk about the rights of women in Palestine, why they don't talk about the rights of women and children in Kashmir.
Very good point
indeed. They're selective in that way.
Mr. Marja, when Joe Biden, he took over the White House, he claimed that the U.S. is once again a reliable partner. He also boasted that, quote-unquote, America is back. But the U.S. decided to leave Afghanistan without much warning or any consultation with its allies. What does the disastrous fallout in Afghanistan say about Joe Biden's claims?
It's a PR effort by Biden to try to salvage the situation. Of course, he's kind of playing off what Trump making America great again. So he is trying to do that, but unfortunately, this is not going to go down well. It is an international embarrassment that will go down in the history of man. As the Taliban, again, you know, you may have the watches, we have the time, and clearly they have demonstrated that throughout the centuries, from stopping the British early on, and then the Russians, and now the Americans. It's only a repeated cycle that even Biden admitted in his press conference in July that this is a graveyard of nations, and I'm not going to, you know, allow the United States to join that. But unfortunately, that was 20 years too late. So I think one of the things that Biden is attempting to do, which unfortunately is not going to be very successful, it's just a sad reality, even though it may have been the right decision, as the fellow speaker was mentioning, it is a costly one politically, because there is no win for Biden here. I mean, there's a loss. And the money that we're talking about, $2 trillion and counting, most of it was spent on the military hardware. More than half of that money was spent on the American military machine, over $1 trillion was just on that. And we're talking about equipment for just the Americans, not the Afghan army or any of them. And if you look at the development funds, I think there's some numbers indicate that only $4 billion. So all these things about women's rights and this focus area was never a focus. And if anybody can open just a cursory review of where the $2 trillion were spent, if you spent even like twice as much that they currently spent, Afghanistan might have rapidly even developed further. But their focus was not that. As President Truman said many years ago, to be careful of and Eisenhower during their time, that we should be careful of this military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, it has come to haunt America again and again with their adventures. And again, that's filling the pocketbooks of certain people. And again, if you know, I just ask the viewers and whoever's listening, just go and examine where those $2 trillion actually went. And just a minuscule amount went to development for the Afghan people. So I think Joe Biden, it's a PR stunt. It's not going to work because the Republicans are hounding. You see Trump, all of a sudden now he's coming out into making comments and speeches. Before he was very silent. And we might even see Trump come back into the White House as a result of this. So we'll see how this plays out. But I think that Biden is in a tough pickle. And I don't think there's a win situation for him either, let alone the Afghanistan debacle.
Chad Qureshi, President Biden, he forcefully rejected criticism of his decision to end America's 20-year war in Afghanistan. And he declared the end of an era in which the United States uses military power to remake other countries, in his own words. The end of an era, it ended on a very low note, if the end of an era was Afghanistan. Do you think Washington has learned its lesson here?
Well, I think it's a good question. If you don't learn the lesson, you will have the same results what you have. With the situation the United States is finding itself in is will be the same if they do the same thing elsewhere. So what needs to happen here is, and I think it's very hypocritical. We're not going to recognize the Taliban government. You've been negotiating with them in Qatar by bypassing the legitimate, so-called legitimate government of Ashraf Ghani more than 2 years. So where was your, that we don't deal with terrorists, we don't talk to them? You have been talking to them. You signed an agreement with them to the very people you call terrorists. So that's one point. The other point is, I think we shouldn't put too much into the PR what President Biden is doing. Everybody knows what the reality is, and the U.S. public and especially the U.S. media is totally a war media. It's run by the Wall Street, as President Trump has suggested a few times, and that was one of the reasons President Trump was thrown out, because the establishment there was most of a security. If they looked at the internal problem U.S. was facing, how many homeless people they have, how many bank and financial scandals the United States has, they wouldn't be in this problem. But the problem is, in the last 50 years, I see that they have been distracting the internal problems, and they have been creating all these. For example, they spent about $6 trillion, I was hearing, somewhere in Iraq. Iraq has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or any kind of terrorists. And the same is in Syria and in Yemen. So they are having these good terrorists and bad terrorists. It sounds like a same script, and they are repeating over and over again. But the real cost which people paid are the U.S. veteran. And I must admit that a soldier is a soldier, no matter which country they belong to. And those soldiers who were fighting this war in the name of defending the country, but in actual fact, they were defending the corrupt regime of capitalists or those financial mafia which is running the United States in military-industrial complex, which moved all the manufacturing industry to China and somewhere else. And they have they are a consumer society at the moment. There's no hardware manufacturing available in the United States. If the United States was a person, nobody will give you £1 as a loan, because the U.S. debt has crossed that ceiling many times.
Okay.
U.S. deficit has gone too high. And these are the things which media or U.S. media and international media is not talking about. Taliban don't care who recognize them or who don't. What really matter is the people who are living in that region. And by taking these kind of action, the United States is further alienating itself from that region.
Okay, I'm going to have to jump in there, Mr. Qureshi. Apologies. We are fresh out of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, Director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Said Mawaz Shah, joining us from Karachi. Thanks to journalist and political analyst Chad Qureshi, joining us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Oh, Hussein, Imam Hussein. Oh, Hussein. The thought on my mind that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insight into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
In the previous program, we concluded that infallibility based on the verses of the Holy Quran is not exclusive, since the Satan in the Holy Quran says, وَلَا أُغْوِيَنَّهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ إِلَّا عِبَادَكَ مِنْهُمُ الْمُخْلَصِينَ I will certainly cause them all to deviate, except the servants from among them who are devoted. This term devoted is a general term, and we can infer from it that this station is reachable to everyone, but with endeavor, discipline, and worship. And of course, that level and that kind of isma of the infallibles, of the leaders and 12 imams, is different from this. But whatever we do, we should consider the fact that everything in the universe is due to Almighty Allah's favor. وَمَا بِكُم مِّن نِعْمَةٍ فَمِنَ اللَّهِ Whatever favor is bestowed on you, it is from Almighty Allah. So, we cannot possess anything without Almighty Allah having part in it. Every being's existence is contingent on the necessary being. So, if there is any perfection in man, it comes from Allah, even the true agent behind teaching common knowledge is Allah. عَلَّمَ الْإِنسَانَ مَا لَمْ يَعْلَمْ The Holy Quran says. He taught man what he knew not. The Holy Quran says that we plow the land, we sow the deeds, and irrigate it, but it is Allah who makes the seeds grow and come to fruition. The Holy Quran in chapter Waqi'ah says, أَأَنْتُمْ تَزْرَعُونَهُ أَمْ نَحْنُ الزَّارِعُونَ Is it you that cause it to grow, or are we the causers of growth?
He who loves you admonishes you from wrongdoing, and he who hates you entices you into wrongdoing.
So anyway, man can attain isma and infallibility with discipline and self-purification. So we can say that isma is not solely for the prophets and the imams. So when one is the prophet or imam, he is infallible, but not the opposite. Man can keep himself from error. He can try to be away from sins and oblivion by self-purification. He can do so before puberty, so he can be ma'asum at puberty thanks to training and purification. Even those who have committed sins or errors can become ma'asum in the future with the same method. The one who enjoys divine training may reach a stage of isma where he will be immune from error in scientific issues. إِن تَتَّقُوا اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَكُمْ فُرْقَانًا. If you are careful of your duty to Allah, He will grant you distinction. So this is another kind of isma and infallibility. So when the verse says يَجْعَلْ لَكُمْ فُرْقَانًا, He will grant you distinction, this means to distinguish between what is right and what is wrong. So, by observing piety and in the light of the discipline received from the saints, man can become a distinguisher of good and bad. What does that mean? This means a very high level, what we can call infallibility, because it means that he will neither misunderstand nor act wrongfully. So, if it is said that a distinguisher may not know certain things, it is because, like other virtues, isma has certain ranks. So we first claim that we can reach infallibility in isma, but on the other hand, we say that isma and infallibility has different stages and levels, but yet it is not exclusive to the 12 imams and the prophets. Because, as we'll discuss later on, prophethood and imamah are exclusive and no one can reach that stage of imamah or prophethood. Because Almighty Allah says, Allahu a'lamu haythu yaj'alu risalata. Allah best knows where He places His message. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
دمعتي عليك ظلت تنزل جروح يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة أدري توفيقي هو أسبابه إلك أسأل وانت تتفضل من توظفني خادم ببابه
يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي أسألك الدعاء
يا وجيها
سيدي أسألك الدعاء يا سيدي
اشفع لنا
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Round the world with reporters.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians burned tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever. While there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action, all spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist in keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the crippling blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance confirms that the Israeli new measures are not enough.
These Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In a small lab in Tehran, a big dream is unfolding. An expert team comprised of over 30 young Iranian physicists and engineers are putting the first building blocks of what would be the first Iranian-made particle accelerator, also called synchrotron. The device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light in a large donut-shaped vacuum chamber. The process seems simple in words, but it's painstakingly complicated in practice.
At the center of this laboratory complex, a fourth-generation synchrotron is located, which accelerates electrons to nearly the speed of light by using radio frequency systems and powerful electromagnets, and finally produces exceptionally brilliant beams of light in a wide spectrum ranging from infrared and visible light to ultraviolet and hard X-rays.
First built in the 1940s, synchrotrons were originally made to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice the synchrotron's byproduct, an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
The X-ray produced in this machine is million times brighter than the other conventional X-ray sources, and it has also unique properties such as high coherency and polarization, tunability, and ultra-short pulses, which enables the scientists to achieve high-quality imaging. Information obtained by scientists can be used to study the structure of viruses and proteins, design new drugs, precise radiography from human body, examine the structure of surfaces, build smaller and powerful computer chips, develop new materials for safer medical implants, and help with the cleanup of mining waste.
The Iranian synchrotron is for now in the R&D stage. The developer's team says the project needs $300 million to be accomplished. So far, only 1% of the budget is supplied. The team hopes by shedding light on the significance of the cutting-edge technology, it can attract the needed investment from the government.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown synchrotron would transform technologies. Experts say, for sanctions hit Iran, building such a device is more than just an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
"We are all in this together" has been the slogan echoed repeatedly throughout the COVID-19 global health pandemic. But time and time again, it's been proven to be little more than intelligent brand marketing, as a global health crisis has laid bare not only the inequalities within societies, but also on the global stage. In Africa, considered the most resource-rich continent on the planet, but the poorest in terms of GDP, less than 2% of the continent's population of 1.3 billion has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. While in comparison, in the European Union, 70% of adults have now been fully vaccinated, according to EU officials, leading to allegations of COVID apartheid in the international arena.
Some countries are now rolling out booster doses to fully vaccinated people, when millions of people around the world have not even received their first dose.
Israel has provided 1 million Israelis their third dose, while only 18% of Palestinians in Gaza have received only one dose of the COVID vaccine.
Meanwhile, the UK, a former colonial power in Africa, is the latest to offer a third dose of the COVID vaccine to around 500,000 Brits. At a time when Africa is experiencing 248,000 new confirmed cases just last week, and 28 African countries are in the midst of a surge in infections driven by the new Delta variant.
And today we're going to go a step further by accepting the advice of the independent JCVI that anyone that is severely immunosuppressed should be offered a third dose.
According to research conducted by the Zoe COVID study, effectiveness in the Pfizer vaccine was at 88% after 1 month, but dropped to 74% after 6 months. And for AstraZeneca, the effectiveness of the vaccine was 77% after 1 month, but dropped to 67% after 4 to 5 months. This arguably demonstrates the need for third booster jabs. However, in low-income countries where there are fewer healthcare workers, weaker infrastructure, and poor access to COVID vaccines, that need is far greater. But their cry for help has thus far been ignored by the very powers that told us we are all in this together. Ahmed Kabbala, London.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control.
Taliban have had some offensive to the Khawak High Pass from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andarab, different districts of Andarab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel, another 35 of them were wounded. 4 armies of Taliban were destroyed, 2 rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
"We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us."
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmad Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Syed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Pakistan has stepped up security along the Afghan border. The move is part of several measures Pakistan has taken to prevent militants slipping into this side of the border. But these moves appear to have made little impact as the number of terrorist attacks has been on the rise in recent weeks. A report by an Islamabad-based think tank reveals that in August, 45 militant attacks took place in Pakistan, the highest in a month since June 2016.
Interestingly, the sudden surge in militant attacks in Pakistan, almost twice as compared with July, was witnessed in a month in which Taliban took over Afghanistan, especially Kabul. So there is a coincidence. It is yet to be verified that is there a direct link or not, but it is a strange coincidence.
According to the report, the number of militant attacks continued to go up since May when the US-led foreign forces started withdrawing from Afghanistan. Most of those attacks were carried out by Pakistani Taliban or Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. Some experts link the rise in militant attacks with Afghan Taliban releasing a number of anti-Pakistan terrorists from jail.
This is because of the security vacuum which has been created, number one, in Afghanistan, and number two, the districts which have been captured by Afghan Taliban, on those districts, TTP prisoners have been released. Along with them, a number of other terrorists have been released. So this fresh wave of terrorism in Pakistan is linked with the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is a banned organization.
The TTP was driven out of Pakistan's erstwhile tribal areas after the country conducted a military campaign in 2015. However, Pakistan says the group still operates out of Afghanistan.
Pakistan hopes the incoming government in Afghanistan will take decisive action against the TTP. But observers are skeptical if Afghan Taliban will do that, given these militant groups often share the same ideology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has reported that North Korea has likely restarted its Yongbyon nuclear power plant, the source of fissile material for its nuclear weapons. The news adds pressure to the U.S. to enter talks with Pyongyang, with the White House facing questions.
Well, we have left the door open and obviously reached out through our channels. I don't have an update for you in terms of any response to our offer. Our offer remains to meet anywhere, anytime, without preconditions.
North Korea has not accepted U.S. President Biden's administration's offer of talks because Pyongyang would like to see an end to what it views as a hostile U.S. policy toward it. In particular, Pyongyang bristles at the U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which restrain North Korea's international trade, and the periodic military exercises involving some 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. Experts at this week's Korea Global Forum for Peace argue Washington needs to do more.
The North maintains that the Biden administration has not proposed a specific or concrete incentive. The U.S. is simply calling on the North to return to the dialogue table, but for North Korea, they need to have some tangible outcome from the talks.
The previous summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump gained headlines, but changed little. With the dispatch of his North Korean nuclear envoy to the U.S. this week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in clearly recognizes time's not on his side, with a presidential election here slated to replace him next March. For U.S. President Joe Biden, however, the North Korean nuclear issue competes on a crowded agenda, with Washington's recent withdrawal from Afghanistan and a surge in COVID-19 cases in the U.S.
Still, the South Korean president seems determined to bring the U.S. and North Korea closer to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians held a demonstration protesting the Israeli illegal policies against Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. The protest aimed at expressing solidarity with Palestinian detainees under hunger strike and demanding the release of Anhar Dik, a Palestinian woman who is expected to give birth in an Israeli jail.
Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails face bad treatment as most of them are detained with no clear charge or trial. Most of the detainees suffer from serious diseases and live in bad health conditions. Amid the medical negligence of the Israeli army, Anhar's is in critical condition as she is expected to give birth in a few days. The international community should be held accountable for the fate of Anhar and her baby.
Anhar is also suffering from pregnancy bipolar depression and afraid for her baby's fate in Israeli prison. The family of the pregnant Palestinian woman jailed by Israel appealed for the international community to set her free to give birth outside prison.
We held this rally to highlight the issue of our Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is going to give birth inside Israeli jails. We call on human rights groups to stand up behind Anhar. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from inhuman Israeli policies. There must be a serious action by the world community.
Eight former Palestinian prisoners gave birth to their children inside the Israeli prisons. Statistics say that out of 39 Palestinian women imprisoned in Israeli jails, 12 are mothers.
This rally aims to send a clear message of solidarity to the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Dik, who is pregnant and deprived of any medical care. We put the blame on the international community that remains silent in front of these violations against Palestinian detainees.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees. Palestinians here demand an end to the Israeli policies and detention against Palestinians, especially pregnant women. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Utter panic has once again gripped Rohingya refugee camps across India amid ongoing COVID crisis. The community is facing yet another campaign for possible deportation, with the government calling them a threat to national security and accusing them of being involved in illegal activities.
From social networks to politicians to TV debates, we are being portrayed as villains. Sometimes illegal immigrants. The only reason is our faith. Otherwise, there are thousands of refugees here. Why are we being treated indifferently? We just want to stay alive rather than being killed in Myanmar.
Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against them has been haunting the community. The UN refugee agency responsible to support these refugees in India is of no help, they say. Activists say the most urgent need for these refugees is food, water, healthcare services, and other basic essentials, rather than a deliberate attempt to target them.
It has been 9 years we are here just to save our lives. We want to go home, but do you think situation there is appropriate for us? We have time and again cooperated with the Indian government in every possible way. We urge India to treat us on humanitarian ground, not on faith. Our case is in the Supreme Court, which is our only hope.
Most of the refugees work as daily wages to make a living, but the recent government restrictions and COVID lockdown have left many out of work. Now the community is struggling on its own to survive. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India. However, since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government in India, the destitute community has become victims of an expulsion campaign. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress. Sometimes detentions in a midnight raids. Sometimes their camps being burnt mysteriously. All they want is a peaceful survival in the world's largest democracy till the situation gets conducive in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis around the world, the community continues to be neglected, but they say they haven't lost hope on Indian democracy despite all hardships. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously.
Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the U.S.-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan. During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil. As the U.S. finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan.
The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the U.S., but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.